Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 120, we'll take tabs on the state of war reporting as seen through the click of a camera.
Photojournalism is alive and well, and if you are lucky enough to be in Britain or have access to some of the papers, you are astonished every day.
That was John Owen, Professor of International Journalism at City University here in London. And we have our Beirut correspondent in London to get a buzz on the Lebanese capital.
They have really cool DJs. The staff is really friendly. I think they won the award of Best Barman of the Year. It's a fun place. It's very well designed.
That was Monocle's own Carol Corm. And we'll hear from C21 media editor Jonathan Webtail with the review of this year's MIPCOM conference in Cannes to find out whether television, as we know it, has a future.
It was interesting in particular to see Netflix represented in Cannes for the first time, a US online DVD rental service, which is very much has its sights set on Europe.
And now, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, October 7th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly with me, Tyler Brulé, our editor, Andrew Tuck, and our culture editor, Robert Bound. Gentlemen, welcome to the new studios here at Midori House.
It's a new story, too.
It is a very new story.
That's amazing. So it's the first time we've actually done something proper in the studio.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I think they did a couple of voiceovers, but in terms of a live program, here we are.
Surrounded by new wood and fresh bays.
It's very new wood.
Welcome to the snooker.
How's your week been, Rob?
It's been busy. It's been good. Testing this place out.
Right.
Running up and down, doing the hoovering.
And how was your weekend so far? You were looking a bit bleary-eyed on Saturday morning.
I did.
Was this pre-freeze-out?
Yes, I got a pre-freeze party in the bag. I came in, brushed my teeth, as you do, come to the studio, do your hair, and that's been ruined by the new headphones.
Did you use the new showers as well?
I didn't.
No.
Make it that far.
Mr. Tuck.
Well, I bumped into him last night. I was saying there's so much going on in this office that you're with people you work with all the time, all day now.
And then they show up in East London to surprise you.
Actually, at the end of the day, you kind of don't want to leave everyone because that's the only thing you can talk about is radio and starting a station. So it's a good job if you hang out because anyone else will be a bit slightly bored by your endless conversations.
No, it was all a buzz on Friday afternoon when I got back somewhat bleary-eyed from Asia.
Yes, and can we just say congratulations as well?
On what?
Because I hear you've been named Editor of the Year.
I have, yeah. Which is a bit of a surprise.
I've never
been able to keep a secret so long. But
it's pretty good.
Yeah, no, it was a surprise. Because I didn't even know that we were in the running or anything like that. This was the Advertising Age Editor of the Year award in the US.
And I think what's always great is that we came in the top 10 magazines in the world.
Yeah, and we're the youngest magazine. Though I was a little bit worried because the other titles that were in the mix were, of course, I think actually U.S. Vogue was number one. New Yorker was there, as was Vanity Fair. But so was Gun and Garden.
Oh, I love Gun and Garden.
Yeah, I think
I never know which one to do first.
It's either Garden and Gun, anyway.
Well, I was going to suggest we add a gun section into Monocle. I think it'd be quite good.
Yeah, beyond defense. I think we just need small firearms as well.
Well, at least a gardening section.
No, it's very nice. Al Gore sent a note, which was good. So that was nice. So we can ask him on the program as well.
Well, it's
not bad company to be in.
No, it's nice.
It's all right.
Yeah. Anyway, it's I think I've got to go get the statuette in New York at some point in November.
We'll come with you.
Okay. Good. We need to do a week of shows because we have to see our friend at NPR as well. Rob, you're putting up your hand.
We have better
messaging technology in the studio. You don't just have to raise your hand.
I was kind of miming how you might lift the trophy, you know, whether it be like winning the Open or the Masters Golf, like sort of kissing it or Rafa Nadal style biting it to check that it's real gold. You've got to practice.
I know. I'm not sure what the forum is going to be.
So anyway, it's been a good week.
It's been a very good week, yeah.
And meanwhile, you've been to Asia and back.
I've been to Asia and back. I was in Bangkok. Did a speech last Sunday, which was great. And that was the TCDC Design Center, which was one of the sort of the legacy projects of Thaksin Shinawatra. It's now been sort of revived now that the family's back in power. And they did a really brilliant conference last week. So we were talking about Monocle to a Thai audience, about 1,000 very eager people, which was good. And then it was down to Singapore and then up to the crazy streets of Seoul. And it was a straight to plane. I haven't done a straight to plane for a while, but I was out with some of our friends from Hyundai Card and many other organizations. And it was
I know that type.
We were still at this place called the House of the Purple, which is quite an incredible concept for a credit card company. they've actually created this space which is only for their purple card holders, which I'm actually quite convinced is just a playground for the CEO, Ted Chung. So he was playing lots of CDs, and he's invested in this crazy sound system from, I think it's like the 1930s or 40s, like two of the biggest speakers you've ever seen. And it's got this wonderful microphone that drops from the ceiling. And he said that he had Mika there a couple of weeks ago just performing for 20 people. Anyway, but Ted was performing for about 8 of us. And then it was to one of Fiona Bay's favorite restaurants. And then it was straight to the JAL flight back to London via Narita.
That sounds very welcome to my underground lair, Mr. Powers.
Yeah, it's back to Japan this week before we kick all of this off. So anyway, this week, London's Imperial War Museum opened an exhibition on one of the UK's most acclaimed war photographers, Don McCullen. But when anyone with a mobile phone can be a photojournalist, what's the use of professionals with an eye on aesthetics? Monocle spoke to Mr. McCullen and the show's curator, Hilary Roberts.
I'm Hilary Roberts, head curator of the Photograph Archive at the Imperial War Museum. Don McCullen is our eyes on modern conflict, quite simply. He's the person who has gone there and taken the photographs so that we can understand something of what happened in those conflicts that he covered during his career. When he was working as a photojournalist in Vietnam, had 3 cameras, 2 light meters, and 30 rolls of black and white film. Photography has become in some ways more accessible today. It has become far more easy to distribute a picture around the world within minutes of something happening. What we have lost, I think, is the opportunity to consider and evaluate. So Don chose his shots. He was very fast, but he had to ration his photography. He only had 30 rolls of film. Once those were used up, that was it. One thing that may not have changed for the better is that Don was able to move around fairly freely, and now, of course, that's not by any means the case. So, and the final determinant of whether a photograph in wartime gets taken or not is, can the photographer actually get there? So, if they can't, the picture doesn't get taken. So how many photographs do not get taken today because the photographers simply cannot get the access they require?
I don't think that what I did in the past is possible to do to this day. Things have changed around. You heard me earlier saying that the newspaper proprietors are not interested anymore in this kind of work in the newspapers. They're more interested in, the lives of rich people and celebrities and good-looking people. So it's a kind of, we've now formed a form of narcissism in our newspapers. It's as if you're only good-looking or rich, can you get into them? And that's not right, really. So it doesn't show a balance in our intelligence or our society. I take great care when I compose my pictures. I want people to look at my pictures. I'm not just taking atrocity pictures I'm trying to convey to people, and the only way I can do that to get their attention is to compose the picture so it's not just an out and out atrocity picture. I'm not saying at the same time I'm creating art, I'm most certainly not, but I'm actually, I'm trying to make the picture look at you and you look at it. I'm not trying to use my work to be rejected, so I try the best I can to get the best possible presentation. The war photographer, what does it mean? It doesn't have a very nice ring to it. It actually has a slightly unpleasant kind of, it's just unpleasant being called a war photographer. It's like being called an assassin, or it's like being called a killer, or a mercenary. It has a mercenary ring about it, and I don't have that mercenary attitude in my makeup. I hope I'm a reasonably decent, honest humanist. By just generating this conversation in this short time, you're not getting, what goes on up in my mind and my soul. You'll have to go upstairs and look at what's up there, and then you'll get a much broader understanding of what kind of person I am.
That was Don McCullen and Hilary Roberts. And now in the studio is John Owen, Professor of International Journalism at City University here in London. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you, Tyler?
Very well. It was interesting at the start of that interview when we heard from Don. He sounded quite angry with newspaper proprietors. Is he justified today?
I don't think so. I think actually photojournalism is alive and well. And if you are lucky enough to be in Britain or have access to some of the papers like The Guardian, you are astonished every day at how remarkable the photography is, the breadth of photography, the witness page that's part of it. Hmm. So I'm not as pessimistic as Don McCullen is, but again, he has battled demons for years because of the images that have haunted him. Mm. I remember seeing a documentary called Dying to Tell the Story in which he actually walked around his home and talked about how the pictures were ghosts and they would come out and haunt him at night. And so I think, here is a man who took some of the iconic images. Every time I'm at the Frontline Club, I'm reminded of Don McCullen, because there in the main room is that shell-shocked soldier from Vietnam that stares at you in the face. So I think Don McCullen has seen a lot in his life and probably is still kind of absorbing what he's experienced.
I want to come back to the notion of ghosts in a second, but Andrew, as a former newspaper man yourself, what do you think of his sort of not really a rant, but certainly a reflection on where the state of journalism is and whether it's British newspapers or papers in general?
I think what he's touching on is something which is just sadly the fact that times have changed. So when you're hearing that story of somebody only having a certain amount of rolls of film, that it took them ages to kind of hike through the jungle, then it was sneaking photographs out. Now we expect to see those pictures in seconds, and it does change your impression of how easy it is to get those pictures. But there's still something when you see pictures printed up and maybe in a gallery or later on for contemplation, that somehow those images really, really do kind of rock you still. So maybe it's not always the newspaper's place, to kind of really make you contemplate about photography. And it's interesting that he says, I'm not an artist. And I'm glad he says that, because around the fringes now of war photography, there are these photographers who are being used as artists.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's something of a divide now, Rob?
I think so, but I also think I kind of agree with John. I mean, obviously, Don McCullen's a legendary photographer, but I think war photography is probably a vocation. I think you kind of can be pigeonholed like that. I don't think most of these people take sort of paparazzi shots one day and then end up doing war material the next day. I think it sort of is something. It's the Maverick. It's the Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now. It's sort of based on these sorts of people. Having 30 rolls of film teaches you to keep your powder dry and aim your camera only when it counts, I think.
And there is a great amount of talent out there doing war photography. And we lost two of the finest this year. Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros killed the same day. And it was sort of a shock to the entire photojournalism industry that these two guys who were taking such risk and getting such incredible pictures died in the same place. But I was looking this morning, actually, I was linked to it by Gary Knight, who is also a very fine photographer and also teaches at Tufts right now. He linked to the best images, 43 images from 10 years of Afghanistan. And you just study those photographers and those images. And I think they would challenge a bit of what Don McCullen was saying about the state of photography. But he's obviously right. It's harder to sell a decent international magazine story with gripping photography. It certainly is that because of the celebrity imbalance. There's no doubt about that.
And it's part of it as well that, one also expects that if you send your correspondent and they're, roaming around the suburbs of Sirte, that, the writer in many ways, should be, probably doing the pictures at the same time. That to actually, really send, a dedicated photographer out there who can practice their craft, that is a bit of a dying art.
But the serious magazines, and you're talking about the award-winning magazines, they still are really using Vanity Fair, still using incredible good photographers, New Yorker magazine on that list. I mean, the best of the magazines that care about photography are still spending money on it. Mm. Obviously, a lot of others aren't. The other thing McCullen didn't take into consideration is the internet. I mean, we've never had more opportunity to really look at remarkable photography from all over the world, and we're really appreciating how many good photographers there are from places that never had access to magazines and now can find ways and showcasing them in things like Flipboard, which it shows you remarkable photography and composed in different ways. So again, I think it's exciting what's going on.
Is it tomorrow that your new recruits start in school, or was
no,
it last
they're
week?
They're already in school. Matter of fact, you know, we were trying to figure out, we're getting you there to talk. But if you, the fact that you couldn't make it yesterday, you were eclipsed by Wada Kanfar from Al Jazeera was there yesterday.
Right. Well, I can do a good follow-up. Don't worry. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, the bar is pretty high, Tyler.
I know. We also have to decide what the assignment's going to be for the students this week as well, because as ever, we're always on the hunt for talent.
No, I think we've got to come up with a good hypothetical for them.
Yeah. And when you survey the classroom, and I just want to go back to photojournalism, everyone is, there. It's wide open for them. I mean, do you already have a sense, from last year and this year, where students who want to be journalists, where do they see themselves?
Well, because they're in an international journalism course, many of them are hoping to find a job in international journalism. That's getting increasingly more difficult, but many of them will go back to their countries and work with their local paper or the national broadcaster or something. I think what the message they're taking away is they have to be prepared to do everything. As you said earlier, often a writer will have to take his own photographs or have to do video. I was talking with someone who's in Beijing for Associated Press, and I was told an interesting thing. He said the people who are traveling are television people because they have to have the pictures. Often the text people are not traveling. The budgets are going to those that produce the revenue, and the revenue goes to the people who take the pictures. So, again, it's a good incentive to learn how to shoot and record video in addition to being a good writer.
Mm. Do you have your lens set, Andrew?
John, I wonder, cutting back for the beginning of the conversation and for your students, do you think that part of the problem with this war reporting or war photography is that it's lost a certain legitimacy because we know everybody's kind of now embedded, they're taken along as on a PR trip almost, that when we see these images or when young reporters try and get out there and do something independently, it's just become that much more difficult and that's lost something in the eyes of the reader.
Well, it's more dangerous also. I mean, that's the other thing. How do you, I had Vaughn Smith, the class actually several weeks ago, and talked about the role of the freelancer. How do you cover Somalia? How do you get to Somalia to take the images that we are rarely seeing? You put yourself at enormous risk, and who would ever probably finance that trip? So I think, yes, to answer your question, I mean, it's not an easy career path, and you have to be prepared to starve a lot. But again, a lot of people are willing to kind of identify a story and go pursue it. And I think we're still awash in pretty substantial imagery from places that you wouldn't think we'd get pictures from. But it is more dangerous. I think that's the most difficult thing. And embedding does restrict what you're going to see. And how you break away from embedding without getting killed is a big challenge, whether you're in Afghanistan or whether you're, still in Iraq or wherever you are.
But do you think it was ever thus, though?
Yeah, probably so. I mean, you can speak to that from Afghanistan, from your own wounds that you suffered trying to do independent journalism. But in Vietnam, I think the difference was, as Horst Foss has often talked about, you could make a choice of where you went. You could decide who you were hitching a ride with. Mm. You could choose your own embedding. I think the difference being now, you don't really have too much of a choice. You can decide to go with the Americans or the British, and most journalists opt to go with the Americans because they have a lot more leeway than with the British.
Mm. Rob, do you think that that journalist, that freelance journalist of the past, who would maybe pick up, a string from Der Spiegel, and they might be able to do a radio report for the BBC. Do you think that's actually more widespread today or not? Because I'm wondering if, someone has to have literally 7 or 8 strings to go and finance it, or do you think people are able to just focus on 2 or 3?
I guess that probably is true. We bemoan the fact that there aren't maybe the network of correspondents, the big newspapers maybe haven't or have pulled back on investing in and having their bureaus and correspondents all over the world. So maybe in order to go and cover one country or one area of one country, one war-torn part of a country, you have to, have seven bosses on speed dial to actually make some money out of it.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, is that the situation? I mean, you're dealing with a lot of our own correspondents, and of course, they're not all on the payroll. And, is that the situation? I mean, when you speak to people who are, in Africa for us or in Latin America, they've really have to have 7 or 8 things on the go.
I think that often the people who are correspondents for us do other things. They need to be, filing stories for several other sources. And they're often trying to do something for TV and for radio. But at the heart of it, most people are still, you know, they still have one real love, and it tends to be the printed word, or it tends to be audio. And obviously, as a media organisation, we encourage people to have, you know, to go with their skills, really.
Mm. John, how much have you noticed, you know, has there been, you know, a sea change over the last decade? You know, obviously, you used to take in interns, you know, in your days at the CBC. And I'm wondering, when you look at, you know, the fresh crop of talent now, do people just know they're going to have a harder time of it, and or should they feel ever so lucky and proud that when they do get an internship with a major news organization that has a bit of cash in their pocket?
Well, I think, you know, the whole notion of internships has become a little more problematic because of the legal restrictions actually on being an intern, because one person's intern is another person's sort of cheap labor that's not being paid. And as newsrooms implode and as staffs get thinner, then a lot of news organizations tend to exploit interns, and it's become a bit of a controversial thing. But the places I've been recently, like Al Jazeera, interns were coveted. They were well-placed. They were used properly. Another interesting variation is to use interns for projects. You know, in a sense, I recall matching up an Italian student of mine with Juliana Rufus, who's a producer correspondent at Al Jazeera. This woman produced what were the bare bones of a story about the Italian-Nigerian sex trafficking connection. This was all her research. That was an internship to me that really worked for both people. Mm. You know, it gave you a real sense of how a news organization worked, or a program organization, and also gave the intern a real chance to show her stuff. So, you know, this is the kind of thing I think Monocle tries to do too, I gather, with interns.
Yeah. I mean, from an expectation point of view, have you noticed a difference in terms of what students are expecting, what kind of gig they hope to have?
Well, I think they're realist. I mean, you know, they can't, you know, they're seeing everything that's being written, and they read the BBC is cutting 2,000 jobs, mm. and they know that the news organizations are imploding. But I think the important thing is that they're introduced to new models, again, whether it's you, Global Post, whether it's talking to people from Al Jazeera. I mean, I think they need to find and hear from people who are trying to find a way to still do good journalism, quality journalism, and they have to be prepared to pay the price. They're just simply not going to have an expectation of a staff job unless they're working for Scandinavian Broadcasting or somewhere that will always have a public service broadcaster supported by the state. I just think that they have to be realistic. They know they're going to have to freelance more, and they're going to have to be multi-skilled, and they're going to have to be prepared to take, you know, not a staff job, but a freelance job.
You've done some time at Al Jazeera.
And done some time. I like that. and I was sentenced to Doha. Yeah, no.
I'm wondering, do you think we'll see the rise of, and it's a question we've asked, you know, within the magazine from time to time, you know, will we see the rise of a serious player on an Al Jazz scale out of Asia? Because, you know, having just, you know, come back from, you know, being in Bangkok and Singapore and Seoul, you know, it's interesting that no one owns that voice when you go sort of up and down, you know, the length of Asia. You know, of course, the Chinese are trying, but I think that's a different proposition. Do you think it will happen that we'll see, a strong, compelling, well-financed Asian voice? Will it happen, you know, probably sometime next, you know, 2 or 3 years as we see the BBC pulling back?
I think actually you're probably better positioned to answer that than I am. But I don't think we'll see one like Al Jazeera, where you had until recently, you had a benevolent emir who was able to give the cash and then remain independent. Again, post Wada Kanfar, you know, we'll have to wait and see whether the guy from the Al Thani from Qatar Gas is going to maintain that same distance. China, yeah, we've seen a huge apparatus, but again, no one believes it will be anything but state-controlled. In India, I think, is more interesting. I mean, who will become the gigantic voice of India? And India is so huge and so decentralized, and there are so many, you know, dialects and broadcasters. I don't know who. You probably have a better idea of who would emerge in India than I do. I don't.
Well, we could probably explore it in class this Friday. When I come to visit you.
Let's do that. Yes. I look forward to having you.
John Owen, thanks very much. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back after this.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. Well, the Sunlanders are almost packed away for the season. Most of the tourists have headed back to Abu Dhabi and Muscat, but things are still more than unsteady next door in Syria. So what's in store for Lebanon for the last quarter of 2011? For this latest instalment of Correspondent Check-ins, we have our woman in Beirut, Carol Corm, who's our woman in London today, in studio. Hello, Carol.
Hi.
Well, thank you for coming in to see us. First of all, starting with something a little bit serious, this week there's been in the news talk about the Syrians crossing the border two or three times into Lebanon in pursuit of people, killing one man. Is there a sense in Beirut that perhaps you can't keep out of the conflict next door? I know that there's been a sense of keeping your head down almost as a nation. What's the feeling now?
We've really tried to, because we're just not strong enough to take it all in, really. I mean, we're just too shaky to take a position. That's why we abstained at the UN last week. We just don't want to rock the boat, because it's a really unstable boat. And the fact that Syria makes incursions in Lebanon, I mean, we had to expect it. Their borders have never been officially drawn out, because it's in Syria's interest to have murky borders with Lebanon. These have always been borders where there's been a lot of trafficking, all kinds. Cars are stolen in Beirut. They end up in these cities. And if you want to get your... there was a funny article today. If you want to get your Mercedes back, you have to pay. And it's probably in these villages where the Syrians are now coming in. This is a very murky region. But there's just a sense for ordinary Lebanese that there's a point where our sovereignty has never been respected. And now is another example of that. The Syrians don't really care. They know that the government is not strong enough to say anything, really. So... Difficult situation and position for the government.
Carol, I just wanted to ask, how is this playing out in a country which has so many, you know, different? I mean, it's probably the smallest country in the world with the most news channels.
Yeah.
And how is leading up to this? How is the Syrian story played out? You know, on these various sort of factionalized
news
channels.
It's so different, you know, because I mean, for some news channels, Syria's the brother, the sister, the friend. And for some other people, it's the worst enemy. So the story is just so different. And it's very interesting to flip from channels to channels. It's always been like this. But, I mean, you know, an event is read in such a different way. That's why people are a little bit tired. They're like, they throw their arms up and they don't know what to think anymore.
Mm. When I was in Lebanon in the summer, and I was surprised when we drove up to Baalbek, and actually there were giant posters up for Assad. And you realise you're only kind of 10 minutes, 20 minutes from the border. Is that feeling something you get in Beirut as well, that you realise there's a constituency there that actually still strongly supports Syria?
Yeah, you feel it. I mean, less so, of course. Beirut is a little bubble, but I mean, Estonian cyclist had been kidnapped a few months ago in the Bekaa. And you're close. Even Beirut is just a two-hour...
My countrymen.
Yeah, your countrymen. That's a murky story, too, by the way. Anyways, you're a two-hour car drive from Damascus, so, you know, Homs, I think today or yesterday they closed the route from Lebanon to Homs, one of the cities in Syria where there's a lot of problems going on. And incidentally, that's the city where Steve Jobs' biological dad comes from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I just learned that this week.
There's a link of the week for us.
Yeah.
Thanks for that late-breaking news.
That was a segue of heaviosity.
Yeah. And a good segue into business.
Yeah, onto business. And and I hear there's potentially some strife there as well on the business front in Lebanon.
Yeah, there might be some strikes. The unions on Tuesday, Miati, our prime minister, who's a huge successful businessman and billionaire, is trying to broker some last-minute agreement with the unions that are basically complaining that the cost of life is too low. Right now, the minimum wage is... I think $300 in Lebanon, and they want to raise it massively.
Per month,
yeah. They want to raise it massively. You know, oil is expensive. And...
Can I just ask you, how unionized is Lebanon? Because actually, when you go there as a visitor, you imagine it being a kind of country of small businesses, of entrepreneurs. You don't imagine there being unionized industries. Is it the docks or something that's unionized? Where do you find the big power of the unions?
Actually, yeah, it's funny. You don't really hear about them until they do these big strikes. But, you know, the... everything, really, from the industrialists to the bank employees to unions like anywhere else, actually.
You've just made my heart beat faster because I just put my furniture all into storage in the docks now.
Now, that,
now that we've emptied the fire, I hope it's safe.
You're going to have to pay off the Teamster.
Carol's going to have to go and check on it once a week. We can move it into your flat.
Okay, well, let's be a bit more cheered up about Lebanon.
I'll take it in my flat.
Let's be a bit more cheery about things in Lebanon. Is there a cultural story that you'd like to tell us that's happening at the moment?
Well, there's a few little things happening. There's an art space opening in Batroun, a coastal city where Kemal has a house. So that's pretty cool because everything's so concentrated in Beirut. It's nice to have places outside of town that are trying to bring people. And so there's going to be film screenings, art residencies, plays, things like this. And
Privately financed.
It's like a group of, you know, hipster Lebanese, one who works for architect Bernard Khoury, one who's at the Tate here. So it's promising.
Can I ask you one more personal thing? I think when we were in Lebanon last time, you'd kind of started your own imprint, your own publishing company. Is that still going on in the background?
Well, I didn't start very well since I started with a guidebook on Damascus. So.
Yeah, well chosen. Well chosen, girl.
But I'm an optimist at heart. So, yeah, I'm hoping to do more cities. I'm just waiting to see where the Arab Spring is going to hit next, and then we'll decide.
And then perhaps on the kind of hospitality front, what's the restaurant of the moment or the bar of the moment?
So the restaurant of the moment is Kokto, which is a restaurant that has been around for like 10 years and claims to have the best bouillabaisse in Beirut and now has opened in the souks, this gleaming, beautiful restaurant. It's the place to be for the next couple of months, and then we'll see where the
and what is it? Is it is it an homage to Jean Cocteau, or what is the design theme?
Yeah, we have a Balthus, we have a Cocteau. The Lebanese are quite into their French artists. Anything that's French is chic.
It was interesting when I was in there, some of the souks, I know that we'd done a few stories about it and wondered how successful it would be, because it's obviously a very contemporary rebuilding of the souks. But in fact, there was quite a few interesting things happening there, and actually Momo seemed to have taken off and been a giant success there.
Momo's a lot of fun. Julian can attest to that.
So you have a few late nights there.
Yeah, I like Momo's. It's nice. They have really cool DJs. The staff is really friendly. I think they won the award of Best Barman of the Year. It's a fun place. It's very well designed.
I wanted to ask a culture question as well. We've had Carol's brought in CDs in the past. We've kind of rather enjoyed them. But also wondered, I'm setting up a story about Turkish soaps and the export of them.
I love Turkish soaps.
And I wanted to know, you know, kind of to take it back to this. Yeah, exactly. So this is genuine enthusiasm.
Yeah, but I shouldn't actually admit to it, right?
No, I'm concerned because I think there's a lot of daytime TV in your life.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. How are these affected? Like, do these storylines affect, you know, do they reflect the political situation, or are they pure froth and soap?
Actually, there's the Syrians were getting quite advanced with them. They were a serious competition to the Turkish and the Egyptian, what they call Musalsalat, the series. And they were a little bit political, you know, they would talk about crime honors, or they would often go back to like these historical epics, you know, when the Arabs were doing so great. So they're very popular, and not everyone will admit to it, but when I kind of admitted in my neighborhood that I was really looking for a pirated DVD because I was leaving and I wanted the next series, everyone like tried to help out and knew exactly what I was talking about, so kind of bonded with the people in the street.
I think this story's written itself. It's going to be a 3,000-word stream of consciousness by Carol. That's a commission.
But there's a really good one, which is called The Forbidden Love, and it was, you really get hooked on it.
Yes. Well, I told you it was a good story.
Absolutely. I thought you were just probably angling to get a little trip to...
Last point. It's interesting because it's all these Turkish also series that are, they're all dubbed in Syria usually. So the accents are very Syrian, and it's a little bit of a joke in the Arab world because they're all on these like mansions in the Bosphorus, but they have a very Syrian Arabic.
Well, Carol, as usual, you made us want to come back to see your country. So thank you very much for popping
Why
in to
you
see
buy
us.
A Damascus guide for me?
we could put them in the shop. Didn't we put them in the shop,
yeah,
maybe?
Did.
Is that
you
going
did.
To be
thank
collector's
you.
Items?
They've sold out.
Anyway, you're listening to the Monocle Weekly here in London, and we'll be back in a moment.
You're back with the Monocle Weekly in London. Yesterday, MIPCOM, the annual conference on the TV entertainment market, finished in Cannes. And though it may seem like all eyes are on iPads, the latest mobiles from Samsung, or computer screens, TV audiences are growing and the medium is as strong as ever. I spoke to C21 Media editor Jonathan Webdell to find out what happened at this year's conference. Jonathan, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And I think you're just waiting at the airport for your flight back to the UK. Yep. I guess it's been a week of kind of cocktail parties and all the rest of it. Through the blur of bubbly, can you tell us maybe which countries are sort of making the running this year in Cannes?
There was a Russian theme, so that was the country that stood out. It's obviously a huge television market, and it's opening up more and more of the trade between Russia and other countries. That was the country around, I think, you know, where there was most excitement.
And in terms of formats, the buying and selling of TV formats, this is what a lot of people know MIP for. Historically, I suppose maybe the UK, the USA are big players in that market. We see the shift eastwards in the art market and in terms of industry and in terms of all sorts of big business. Is this the same in the TV world and in the format world? Is there an eastward shift?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think one of the most interesting developing markets at the moment is Southeast Asia. So again, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of representation from Malaysian broadcasters and production companies as well. So you're looking at Malaysia and Indonesia, I think, in particular, becoming really much more active players on the international scene.
And in terms of sort of the tech side of it, people are buying 3D TVs. People are watching the TV on their phones, on their iPads. Is the technology a considerable part of MIP, or are people still thinking about TV on a TV set?
I think it's very much a part of MIP. I think it has been for a number of years. And it was interesting in particular to see Netflix represented in Cannes for the first time, a US online DVD rental service, which is switching its business over to online streaming. They were there at the market, quite under the radar, really, in some respects, but they had a number of representatives around going and acquiring content. They announced down there that they had picked up a Norwegian drama called Lilyhammer, which is very interesting given the excitement that there is around the world and the interest in Scandinavian dramas, given the success of The Killing and the remakes that there have been of that in the US.
I wondered whether, you know, MIPCOM really is sort of like a looking into the sort of TV and entertainment industry crystal ball. Do you, you know, when you're considering things and you're getting back on your plane to the UK, do you kind of feel like you've maybe seen the next year to 5 years of technology and of TV formats? Do you feel like you're, you know, getting a privileged sort of view of what's coming up on everybody else's TV screens?
There were glimpses of, obviously, some of the big shows that are coming up. There was a lot of excitement around. Kiefer Sutherland was in town together with Tim Kring, the creator of Heroes, and they're developing a new show for Fox called Touch. And there was a real buzz around the trailers that they showed off there. So that seems to be one of the shows that was creating a lot of excitement.
All right, Jonathan, we better run to your plane.
Cheers, bye-bye.
Could you hear the champagne corks popping in the background?
He didn't sound very excited, did he?
I know. I went a couple of years ago and I had a really good time.
You made a wonderful film and it looked like a proper, you know, film come TV come meat market.
I presume it's M-E-E-T.
Absolutely. It's a meet and greet market.
He gives a good meeting. Oh, I tell you what.
but it's like a bit of a, maybe it was a quiet year, I don't know.
I don't know. It kind of did sound that. I think there seems to be a shift in the technology and in the platforms rather than the formats. Mm. I don't know whether anyone's unleashed a new X Factor, a new Big Brother, a new Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. These are the sort of things. So it's more about distribution models and these, like you mentioned, Netflix.
Yeah.
You know, a postal DVD rental company becoming a distributor and all this. It's sort of interesting, but not as interesting as, you know. glittery skirts and ice skating, is it?
Well, and on that topic, maybe no skirts involved, but I do wonder how polarized, you know, the world of the TV market's also becoming, because I bumped into a TV executive from a media company from Singapore in Seoul this week, and he said, you just, if you're an Asian player, you have to go to Seoul, you know, if you want to do anything when it comes to sort of, you know, music, TV formats, you know, right now as well. So you also wonder, you know, how much is sort of, you know, the meet and greet market actually just cut out as well, particularly at the speed at which things move right now.
Yeah, it is that. I mean, that's what I guess the success of these things is. Everyone has to sort of be there. It is about meeting people face to face and all the rest of it, and getting a bit drunk, you know, on the Croisette sort of helps. But also, it's funny, you know, talking about this show Lilyhammer, which sounds quite interesting. It's maybe something we should look at.
Yeah.
It's that there's a sort of, there's always that herd mentality in all of these marketplaces. It's kind of like, right, you know, the killing, the, you know, hot, you know, Scandinavian noirish thrillers. You know, everyone's heading that way, and it's kind of, there's a stampede to kind of, yeah, slightly sexy girl detectives in jumpers.
Big fluffy jumpers.
You gave me a weird look there. I don't know. There was no subtext to that whatsoever.
I was trying to think of a segue to our next piece.
Oh, no.
Anyway, on the topic of television, the autumn television season in the US has seen yet another retro-themed series premiere on ABC in the form of Pan Am Airways. As luck would have it, the mother of our correspondent in New York, Aisha Spears, was a stewardess for Pan Am in its most golden of years. Our design editor, Hugo McDonald, met up with her in London to get her thoughts on what's been happening to air travel since Pan Am ceased operation in 1991.
It opened a whole new life for me coming from Malaysia. It's something that I've always wanted to do, is to see the world. And the only way you can do it is be a Pan Am hostess. I was hired in Singapore and flew all the way to New York, a day in New York, and then on to Miami to be trained as a Pan Am hostess in the early 70s.
What an amazing life. And what was the training like?
Training was wonderful. And you end up having to share with six other people, mainly other nationalities. My roommate was from, I think, Sweden, a Norwegian girl. And the other person is from Beirut. So it was all very international. The whole training was about 6 weeks. And everybody is very envious of another, because either they're prettier, they're skinnier than you are, or they're darker or lighter or whatever it is. But it was a fun time. It was a fun time.
And did you have to carry books on your head to make sure that you were walking straight?
We were told to do that, but it's only a selected few who needs to be corrected on their appointment. I was lucky enough I didn't have to do it.
Well, the air hostesses themselves are very legendary, and something that comes across quite nicely in the show is the fact that it's opening a new era for women to see the world.
Yes.
But also there's sort of a lot of bottom pinching in the aisles that goes on. Mm. Were you ever...
No, I was... Well, should it be lucky or unlucky? I was never had that experience. But yes, we do sort of hear stories about, you know, passengers pinching bottoms, but fortunately, it never
Not
happened.
You got some concert tickets, though.
Yes, we had a lovely time in Sydney. We were invited specially by Ike and Tina Turner to their show, because we took them from Honolulu to Sydney, and the crew was given a front row seat, and a song was specially dedicated to the Pan Am crew. So we were very, very fortunate. And on top of that, we were invited to the party after the concert, which we all went to. I had lots of fun. And we had a few more other concerts. You know, we went to the one with Cliff Richard in New Zealand and Elton John.
I can't imagine that happening today. I think the level of service back then must have been in a completely different league compared to what it is today.
Yes, I think so. And don't forget, the flying today is so different from when I was flying. I think people expect a lot more now for paying very little. But I think when I flew, it was very different. And don't forget, there was only two classes of service. We had first class and economy, and that was it. What used to be economy is what business class is like now. So the service is fantastic. First class was the best place to be flying. And Pan Am had the first airline that did the restaurant up in the air. I don't know if you're aware of that, where we have a dining room service. And we had two tables for two. Two tables for four, and we used to match passengers. If they were a single traveller, we said, oh, would you like to sit with that beautiful-looking blonde? So it was fun. It was lots of matchmaking, you know. And as a flight attendant myself, I think that gave me a completely different lifestyle. You know, it was a lifestyle for me. You went to all places in the world that otherwise, you know, you'd have to pay a lot of money for. I had a good life with Pan Am.
And I think one of the most telling things is the fact that there's still such a big community of former stewardesses and stewards, yes, who are such good friends still.
Yes, a lot of us still get in touch with each other. We know we have what we call the Pan Am Whirlwings, where crew members of all kind of seniority gets together once a year, and they have the Whirlwing chapter in Hawaii. We have a Whirlwing chapter in New York, where all the old senior stewardess get together for a meal. And the latest thing they did last year was they all got together and went on a cruise around the Hawaiian Islands. And friends of mine went on that. Unfortunately, I was too far, couldn't get it.
But when the show airs in London, you're going to gather some people together?
Yes, I'm hoping to get a lot of Pan Am people, if they fit into their uniform, to come in, and we'll have a real splash with, you know, Pan Am signal and everything else in there.
Do you think there'll ever be another airline like Pan Am?
Or no, definitely not. Pan Am is the only way to fly. No way. Pan Am is it.
And part of it was the fact that it was this excitement about the future.
Yeah, exactly. I think Pan Am carries a lot of weight as far as being a name itself, but I don't think there'll be another airline like Pan Am. From my experience, that's the only way to fly.
And the big question is, can you still flash a Pan Am smile?
Oh, definitely. Yes.
Yes, she can.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you very much, City Spears.
My pleasure.
That was our Hugo McDonald talking to City Spears, the mother of our New York correspondent and editor, Aisha Spears. It's amazing. I mean, you just want to, you know, if you're sort of, you know, managing a small fund, many people have tried to sort of throw money at starting again, but I want to get back on the plane right now, and I want to be seated by, you know, whether it's sort of the leggy blonde.
It's properly Catch Me If You Can material. It sounded so good. I felt like I was back in like the late 60s. It sounded so cool.
She's amazing. I caught up with her when she was in the office in the week, and she was talking about when Aisha was a kid, and she'd say to Aisha, why didn't we go to New York for the weekend? And you imagined that the freedom you would have being a Pan Am stewardess. And also, I think it's strange when you look at American Airlines now and how their reputation is really terrible compared to any other kind of nation's airlines. But back then, you know, Pan Am and TWA, they summed up a certain glamour. There was a kind of a possibility of seeing the world, you know, and that those first Pan Am jumbos, they were amazing.
It was interesting when I came back from Japan at the weekend. It was amazing. I was with some airline executives from what is now Japan's biggest carrier, ANA, and they were actually talking about, you know, what happened in the United States. And they said, because Pan Am was just an international airline, it wasn't concerned with, you know, connecting people between, you know, Chicago and then getting them, you know, out to Omaha or something like that. They said, you know, their whole mission was just to fly the world. And in many ways, you know, it reminds you a little bit of Emirates, the way she sets it up, because, you know, Emirates, of course, doesn't have any domestic traffic. It's just a global carrier. It's like Singapore, and it's made up of all of these, you know, ladies and men from, you know, 36 or more, you know, different lands. And I'm very keen to see it, especially, and I hope it makes it here, because the other retro theme series, I already heard that the Playboy Club was already canned this week. NBC already got rid of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think after sort of three or four airings, it had such low low numbers that it's already gone.
Not such a good tail fin as a bunny rabbit tail.
Absolutely. Anyway, also at our recent party, I'm going to stay on the Pan Am theme. We sat down with interior designer Beverly Ryder, who also chose Pan Am as her most missed brand.
I'm going to say Pan Am, because I think it's an iconic brand that symbolizes the lifestyle of its time. When you look down Park Avenue now and you see Park Avenue South, the old Pan Am building, which is now lit up at the top and says MetLife, doesn't really work in the same way. It also made me think about the uniforms, which were totally cool and iconic of their time, and thinking about the movie Catch Me If You Can with Leonardo DiCaprio, which surely must have been based on that whole lifestyle and design aesthetic. So I'm going to say that. I think it was very much about the time, you know, that we all associate the 60s and the world opening up, the whole idea about the jet set life that everyone wanted to aspire to. And Pan Am really represented that in a way that, you know, maybe Virgin Atlantic would like to, but it's not really working for me anyway.
was Beverly Ryder. Rob, how are you? You've got a big grin. Now it's your turn.
I was just smiling at that little package. That worked.
Yeah,
didn't it?
It did work.
Yeah.
I thought you were thinking about maybe a new jumper you're going to go buy.
Oh, you've got that old jumper look on your face again.
You do, don't you? Do you have any music for us today?
Yeah. Well,
did you know this is the culture segment we're in?
Sort of, I know.
It's an extended play today.
I'll just consult the script here.
Yeah,
that.
I do. You need a script stand in this, or do you? I'm actually thinking my laptop actually works as a pretty good script stand.
That's all right, actually. You're backlit.
It is backlit, actually.
And you can't see anything.
No.
We do. It's fun at the moment because obviously we're choosing all the music that's going to go on the station.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant job.
Say the word station again.
Station. Radio station. Come on, say it. You say it.
Radio station.
Right.
Don't let Andy say it.
And we're going to be playing things like this. This is Anna Brun, who is born Norwegian, lives in Sweden.
And she sang on with Coop, didn't she?
I think she did.
She sang...
Yeah, she did. Yeah, that's right.
I think she sang one of the... I think it was the main song off of their second album.
So she gets around in a nice way.
Yeah.
She works with Benny Andersson, Peter Gabriel. Don't laugh, Andrew. Not everything is funny. That's not...
There's a Norwegian theme.
Yeah.
Do you think she's been to Lillehammer before?
Okay, it shouldn't be funny, but it is. Just play this song. The song is called Do You Remember? Bit of tribal drumming.
And rather rude lyrics for a Sunday morning.
Sorry. I'm sorry,
I'm wondering what happens next.
I was just all about the percussion. Tune in next week.
I like the little pop. I wonder what that pop was.
She's good, isn't she?
Yes.
I said she got around in a good way.
Yeah, I like her very much.
So it'll be things like that and more.
Mm. Andrew, did you like it?
Yeah, I loved that.
And Brun.
I loved that.
Mm.
She's done 8 albums, which I'm kind of amazed. Oh, she's one of those people that sort of work with all sorts of people. There's a really good Swedish band called First Aid Kit, who is 2 19-year-old Swedish sisters, I think, who are amazing. They collaborate with her on this album. She's kind of like, she bestrides Scandinavian pop like a colossus.
Great.
You put that on the poster. I said exactly. That purely so they can put that on the poster.
Guess what I have over here, Rob?
Guess what? Hi, what is that?
I've got special messaging. I can message the control room.
I've got like a BBM to the studio.
I don't need any of my hand signals anymore.
Okay. I still have to do them. I can't really see what's going on your screen.
I have no idea how to use a PC. But anyway, that's just a whole other story.
You've gone a bit call center here. I didn't expect to see you like this.
It is very call center.
I'm just patching you through.
Yeah, no, it's very call center, or it's like it's trader on a budget. Because I had to bring in my own screen.
You've only got one Bloomberg screen.
Yeah, no, I don't have like 8 Bloomberg screens. Soon, though, they won't be able to see the guests.
Yeah.
It's time for a break. This is the Monocle Weekly in London. We're back in a moment. You're back with the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for this week's monologue by our associate editor, Jonathan Openshaw, on the over-ambitious job title.
The idea of a shape-shifting career isn't a new one. Since the start of the 21st century, the press has been keen to paint a picture of a company-hopping, vocationally slutty generation trying on new jobs about as often as their parents would have bought an outfit. On a recent trip to Turkey for Istanbul Fashion Week, I noticed that the fast-forward button had been pushed on this trend, however. Instead of getting through 8 careers in a lifetime, people were juggling 8 careers in a day. I met a bar owner come publisher and a shoe designer come advertising exec, whilst the agency organising Fashion Week were not only in events but ran a publishing house on the side, consulted for luxury brands, edited guidebooks, generated a monthly magazine and represented various chefs and celebrities across the city. They also DJed at the after parties. A casual opening question of, and what do you do, could easily eat up an hour of your evening. The stack of business cards that I came away with from that trip are a baffling jumble of professions and pretensions that would make my dad, who has worked in the same institution for approaching 30 years, break into palpitations. The roaring economy on the Bosphorus may encourage entrepreneurial initiative, but even with my friends in London, having a couple of jobs on the side is now the expectation rather than exception. As careers get more varied, lifestyle brands are getting more focused, however. Take food, for example. If I'm juggling 5 roles at work and making 500 decisions a day, the last thing I want is a multiple choice questionnaire at dinner. Fusion menus are very much on the way out amongst savvy diners from New York to London, and the rise of the one-dish menu can be seen in cities around the world. America is a hotspot, with the likes of the meatball shop in New York's East Village serving up nothing but you guessed it, and Mac Bar in Lolita offering 12 varieties of macaroni cheese. The ramen stands of Tokyo and pho stalls of Hanoi have experienced an unprecedented resurgence in recent years, whilst cheese toasty wars are being waged amongst the mono-menu rivals in Singapore. The same can be seen in media, of course, and while it's great to have a Twitter feed of information at your fingertips, there's a solid and growing market for media brands that narrow down rather than open up and take an opinion rather than broadcast the babble. In a world of multiple careers and endless information, it seems there's always time for a simple meal, without any sauces and foams, while you flick through a reassuring wedge of a magazine. If I were a young Turkish entrepreneur, I'd be setting up a quality burger joint just about now, whilst holding down the day jobs, of course. For Monocle, I'm Jonathan Openshaw.
Oh, our lovely little Jonathan Openshaw.
That was very good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
We actually need a burger joint around here.
Yeah.
And Rob, you can have a salmon burger or something, but
I love that.
And Rob, are you vacationally slutty?
What? Am I vocationally slutty?
That's what he says.
Far less in real life than I pretend.
I haven't actually heard much more since his trip to Turkey.
Yeah, I wonder how slutty... No, sorry. All vacation. It was all vocational, I believe.
Of course
no,
it was.
No, he had a good time, so not only did he kind of...
Sorry, you don't have to stick up for him. I mean, no, I'm sure we'll read about it.
He hooked up with a good magazine. Crew there.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like
he's been passing on names of writers and everything.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
I think it's true. What would you do?
If I wasn't doing this,
you've got a number of sort of hats. Now it's call center. You're going to have to quieten down on some of those because you're busy.
I know. Actually, I've got some calls coming in because it's actually some people making some returns of some of our jumpers, some of our special jumpers. Hold the line, caller. We do need a phone-in element, don't we? A global phone-in.
It is.
I think let's just get the whole thing up and running first, and then we can do global phone-in.
You could get you get cabbies phoning in, like you would on LBC or something, from Seoul.
Well, I was going to say from Seoul or sort of Bangkok.
Yeah, but like the Seoul taxi drivers never know where they're going, so they could be phoning you up in London, kind of going, "Yeah, I'm take a left down at the take a left down at the Bimbop bar, and you'll find it."
From the tuk tuk. I think that. How did the new studio drive today?
I think it went pretty smoothly, right?
Yeah, we need to tighten up this table. The table's too wobbly.
Yeah, because there could be a coffee accident.
There could be a real coffee accident.
And then you wouldn't be happy.
I wouldn't be happy at all, would I? Anyway, that's all for this 100th and 20th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Don Trump.
Boom, boom, boom.
No, it's great saying Don Trump. Yeah, we have so many good names.
We need Trump after that.
So many good names with our new colleagues. I absolutely love it. But that's D-A-W-N, Don. And our sound engineer is Chris Sharp here at Midori House. He works here now. Did you notice that?
We stole him.
Some things never change.
No, I know.
Like Sharpie.
I think that's why we got hijacked for this last few weeks at the sound company. Anyway, if you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember to catch up with us daily via our, what is it, Rob?
Monocolum.
Very good. Anyway, for now, from all of us here, I'm Tyler Brûlé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Bound.
We went in a bit in the wrong way this week, actually, because normally it sort of was clockwise, now it's... No, it was clockwise, it was counterclockwise, the way we used to sit.
That's an apple cart that's been...
completely
come unstuck.
Tipped over. Anyway, more from Midori House next week. Goodbye.